Good evening. Welcome to the last of our spring semester science fiction writers series. Tonight we have Scott Huggins speaking. He was born in California but raised in Kansas, which may explain not only his profound personality conflicts, but also his tendency to punch people who make Wizard of Oz references around him. He's still figuring out what he wants to be when he grows up, but is perfectly willing to write science fiction and fantasy until that time. He received his BA from Kansas State University and his MA from Michigan State University. He now lives in Michigan, where his hobbies of bookselling and cat maintenance take up the time he does not devote to writing. His works have appeared in Writers of the Future, Volume 15, Amazing Stories. Other stories are appearing in Andromeda Spaceways and Karen Joy Fowler's Mota 3 Courage anthology. He has also published poetry, but other than that, is a nice guy once you get to know him. Welcome, Scott. We're looking forward to your readings.
Well, what can I say to an introduction like that except, wow, all my opening jokes just got used for me. thank you very much. However, since all my opening jokes got used for me, I think I'm going to open with a rather longer joke, which is the story I recently sold to Andromeda Spaceways in Flight magazine, which is in Australia. It will be coming. It's an Australian publication. It will be coming out October of this year. And if this were Australia, that would mean you could rush right out and buy it. So, if any of you happen to find yourselves in Australia at the end of the year, please. All right. This story is called Bovine Intervention, and it's inspired by many nights when I stayed up till about 4 in the morning playing with oddly sided dice. I grabbed the branch at the apex of my leap, barely getting my knees up in time to feel the wind of the monster's rush below me. It skidded to a halt at the edge of the clearing and let out a slavering cry of rage and pain. I took the opportunity to flip two broadhead arrows into the hump on its back. It barely seemed to notice. Beside me, I heard a rustling. In the next tree over was our fearless leader, Jeff the Merciless. I scanned the sides of the road for signs of a bloody smear. No such luck. Frisee was still right beside him, wearing a sick sort of grin. I swore and knocked another arrow. This one penetrated the shoulder of the huge bull, which remained oblivious. I glanced across the narrow road at Jean, who rolled his eyes at me from the top of the rock he'd scrambled up. With a look behind him that was half-disgusted, half-leer, Jeff the Merciless flipped down out of the tree and unsheathed his longsword. The bull, soaked with blood and sweat, seemed to consider for a moment. If I'd been the bull, I'd have been trying hard not to laugh. Jeff was thin as a stick, with erratic bursts of straight black hair jutting from chin and chest. He wore no tunic and a huge codpiece. The sword was almost as long as he was, and his helmet had spikes on it that made him look like some deformed challenger for control of the herd. The bull must have come to the same conclusion. With a braying howl, it charged. Jeff stood his ground. I sent two more arrows into the bull, and it finally stumbled. At the last instant, Jeff danced aside and brought the sword down with both hands. Then he was bowled over in a rush of muscle and blood. The carcass of the bull slammed into the tree, and with a squawk of protest, Rissé came tumbling out of it. I jumped from my tree the same instant that Jean came hurrying up to Jeff. Slowly, I walked over to where Rissé lay, shaking her head in a daze. She looked up with big, green eyes. "Ow," she said, wincing prettily. I nudged her with a toe. "Aren't you going to help him?" I asked. "Who?" She shook her head, and I fought the urge to kick it. "Scow means, would you mind getting your pretty ass over here and helping me?" Jean said in an acid monotone, but she's too diplomatic to say so right out. "No, I'm all right," Jeff grunted, staggering to his feet. "Really?" He leaned on his sword. His right shoulder was clearly out of the socket. Below it was a deep gash. I whistled softly. If the horn that had caused that had been an inch more to the right, our fearless leader's intestines would be decorating the forest like party streamers. "You're not all right," Jean growled. "Now sit back before I sit on you. I've got to bless these wounds." "Unless our mage would care to do the honors," I broke in. I decided it was time to have this out. "A demonstration of your healing skills, perhaps." "Chow, leave her alone. She's hurt." So are you, I pointed out, his mispronunciation of my name grated. But you had to hand it to Jeff. When there was a cute girl to impress, he was indeed very brave. I shook my head. What I don't understand is why you turned that rather non-threatening forest troll into a bull. Well, Jeff the Merciless wanted to see what I could do against the minions of Baron Overdark, so I transformed it into a bull, I said. Well, you changed a beast only slightly stronger than a man and armed with a club into an enraged mountain of flesh armed with twin yard-long ivory spears. She looked like she was about to cry, but I didn't care. I had a terrible suspicion. Why didn't you turn it into, say, a frog? She started, but I'd had enough. I remember when we ran short of water yesterday, you provided us with liquid from your magical horn cup. Pray remind me, what was that liquid again? Milk, she said in a small voice. And the horn cup came from a cow? She was looking at the dirt. And can you help our fearless leader? Well, I could if he was a cow, I finished. She glared at me. I do cows, okay? What's wrong with cows? Nothing, I exploded. I like them myself, grilled and medium rare. She looked sick. I turned to Jeff. You hired us a monomage. A what? He looked stunned, and not just from blood loss. I looked at Rise. She was staring at the ground again. A monomage, a wizard or sorceress who can affect only one class of things, and in Rise's case, that happens to be cows. But I hired a mage who could shapeshift, Jeff gasped. Are you telling me that if she transforms, it'll be into a cow? I finished. You didn't say anything about transforming into a cow. He sat down heavily. Jean began praying, and I wondered how effective that would be while he was laughing under his breath at his patient, but then Jean's gods always seemed to me to be a fairly relaxed sort. Yes, that's a common negotiating ploy, I told Jeff. It's called lying. Oh, shut up, Jeff flared. You've been on her back ever since we hired her for this job. And so has she, I didn't say, beneath you, which is why we hired her in the first place, isn't it? To be fair, she looked impressive when she'd answered our want ad back at the inn. She wasn't badly muscled, and she'd been bedecked with amulets twisted into strange animal shapes of an eldritch nature, which is always a good sign in a mage for hire. I was our sniper and scout, Jeff was our stand-up-and-fight warrior, and Jean was along to win favor of whatever local gods we might happen upon. But we badly needed someone to help us out with the magical end of things. Priests could only do so much, and even a petty local heavy like Baron Overdark should have had some magical defenses. He was converting the farms around the area into his own private estates, and there were an even dozen quietly offered rewards out there to whomsoever would bring the Baron to his untimely demise. We'd needed a mage, and Jeff the Merciless had been smitten at the first sight of Rise. He'd signed her on right there. I looked at Rise's silver and bronze amulets. They twinkled around her neck. Wolf, raven, lion. Where's the cow? I asked. They don't make cows, Rise sniffed. No one hires you when all you do is cows. Cows was what I was good at. Jeff sat up and Jean sat down, panting. The healing had taken something out of him. Jeff was obviously feeling better, though. You signed on as our sorceress and all you do is cows? You bitch, he yelled. That's dogs, not cows, I pointed out. Shut up, bitch, Jeff screamed at me. You never said anything about cows. Get the hells out of here, you lying whore. Tears of rage filled Rise's eyes. You can't do this. The hell I can't. Who's leader of this expedition anyway? He drew his sword. It'll protect me from cow transformation, sister, and from any other mutineers, too. I lead this quest. You see anyone else here with a the after his name? Do you? You can't. She's right. Jeff whirled on Jean, who was still fighting laughter. What do you mean I can't? Jean just looked up. Magical contract. She signed it. You signed it. It was part of our quest until party is dissolved by death, accomplishment, or mutual consent. Jeff turned, and the gleam in his eye was ugly. Death coming right up. Gods, Jeff, you might as well try mutual consent first. I stepped between them. You deceived us. We found you out. Now will you go away? No. Her eyes were set, hard. I didn't deceive any of you. You asked for a wizard and I am one. She raised her hands in a gesture. Mock me at your peril. I will not be cowed, I asked. She flushed, looked about to cry. Death, said Jeff, stepping forward. No, Jeff, I don't think so, I said, unfolding a piece of parchment. Under the terms of the contract, we also swear not to kill one another under penalty, in my case, of the gods amputating my bow fingers, in Jean's case, eternal damnation, in Risse's case, I squinted at the small print, being forced to eat an entire side of beef. Yes, might have paid a bit more attention to that one, Jeff. I thought she was concerned about her figure, Jeff snarled. You chicks are always moaning about fat here, flab there. I stroked the tip of an especially sharp broadhead and continued reading. In your case, you lose your... I looked up. There was no need to go on. He'd gone as pale as his sword. Why on earth would you swear that? I asked, honestly puzzled. His mouth worked. Finally, he said, when your name ends with the merciless, people tend to want extra guarantees. It's what I always swear. I see, I said. I was glad I was the right gender and didn't have to put up with that nonsense. Always gifted at changing the subject, Jean spoke up. Well, at least your gifts will be coming in useful tonight. Eating sirloin of troll wouldn't be nearly as much fun. I snorted. So she won't help us win any battles, but we'll be well fed after the battles we do win. There are worse things to be said about a great many sorceresses, said Jean gravely. He stepped over to the former troll and got out a large butcher knife. The smell of the steaks was making all our mouths water except for Risse, who looked slightly ill and sat gnawing on a turnip. Jeff and I were up to our elbows in gore, passing Jean the slices of beef that could be preserved. I hardly noticed his chant of sustaining until it cut off abruptly. Damn it, Jeff, you've got to debone it better than... Well, what have we here? We turned to look as Jean pulled a silver medallion from a ragged piece of stomach. I thought this was a cow, not a goat. Worse, it was a troll. I reminded them they'll eat anything, including a rock if they have to. I trailed off, noticing the look on Jeff's face. That's the medallion of Chad the Turbulent. He took it, holding it up in the firelight. Are you sure? Asked Jean. Positive. This is the corner he always used to gnaw on when he was nervous. Jeff pointed out the ragged edge. Chad was a fire mage of the 8th parallelogram. He wouldn't fall to a simple forest troll. The consequences settled over us like a badly fitting cloak. An 8th parallelogram fire mage might have taken us all out without working up a sweat. We're sure this troll was a sentry for Overdark, I asked. Yeah, I found his union card back there. Forest Minions, Local 1624. That's Overdark. Jeff spat, and he seemed to think... The plan could still work, he finally said. Jean said mildly, is that the plan where we jump out of the woods and charge straight at the gates of the manor, slaying all unfortunate enough to stand in our path? Jeff turned a venomous eye on him. Oh, I guess you're going to stick up for her now, he said, slashing carelessly in my direction with his knife. I'm Jeff the Merciless. I'm not supposed to sneak around like a thief. I'm a barbarian warrior. If you'd hired Chad for us, that might have worked, Jean said, or not. Nevertheless, we don't have him on our side. No one does. We have us three, and we have a cow mage. I don't see where you get off blaming me, Jeff said. Seems to me that if I hadn't hired Risse, we'd all be walking right into a trap. We wouldn't have stopped to butcher a troll. Looks to me like I made a damn good decision. His eyes gleamed, and he looked at Risse, who blushed. She didn't seem to remember him calling her a bitch just 2 hours ago. I turned away to hide the look of disgust on my face. Steaks are done, I grunted. Oh, don't get too jealous, Chow, Jeff called to me. Come morning, my little wizard and I will have a fine plan for attacking Overdark and carrying off his treasure. You just rest those little eyes. Wouldn't want your precious arrows going astray. We heard Risse and Jeff making up loudly in their tent that night. The next morning, Jeff was looking especially pleased. Feast your eyes on the new tactical genius who defeated Lord Overdark, he said, grinning. A brilliant plan came to me in the night. Came with you during the night, you mean? I snorted. Jeff glared at me, then got out his map. Look, it's a day's hike to Overdark's castle, right? But that's if we walk straight there, not if we have to scout ahead and watch out for patrols as gamekeepers and all that. So here's what we do. Chow scouts ahead to see who's coming. When she finds a patrol, she comes back to meet us. Then Risse changes us all into cows. I waited. Jeff had a triumphant smile on his face. Yes, I said, but there's just one part of the plan I see a problem with. Jeff looked annoyed. What part is that? The part after, so here's what we do. God damn it, I've had enough of your shit. You want to challenge me for leadership of this quest, do you? He drew his sword, fuming. Jeff, said Jean, it's stupid, I yelled. Even if she could turn us all into raging bulls, we'd be more effective in our true forms. I can't shoot arrows as a bull. Besides that, how are we going to carry our equipment? That troll couldn't even carry his club, let alone the gear we have. You expect us to just charge up the stairs of Overdark's Manor and gore him to death? Well, actually, no, said Jeff, and I could tell that I had made a mistake. His grin got wider. You see, what you probably haven't thought of is the fact that, among other things, Baron Overdark does raise cattle. And there will be 4 stray cattle in the middle of his road, just the perfect thing for a gamekeeper looking to win a bit of favor from his lordship. As for your point about the equipment, I'm glad you mentioned that. We've got some of that bullskin from yesterday. We should be able to sew our vital equipment up in it and attach it to one of us. When Rusek turns us back into our natural shapes, the bag falls away, we get dressed and armed and sneak into the mansion. With the element of surprise, victory will be ours. Does that meet with your approval, Chow? The speech sounded rehearsed, and Risei was looking pointedly away from Jeff. It was easy to tell whose plan it really was, but I had to admit it seemed a good one. I didn't like the thought of being a cow, much less a cow in the power of an enemy like Overdark. I said as much. Don't worry, said Jean. It takes a fairly complex ritual or piece of enchantment to make a transformation spell permanent, am I right? Risei nodded. Even if everything goes wrong, we'll be human in a few hours. Exactly. She stepped forward and seemed to recover a bit of the assertiveness she'd dug up when being asked to leave the group. I will be wearing this amulet. She pulled out a lump of silver on a wide leather strap. It was covered in runes. That's a cowbell, said Jean. He looked as if he was about to start laughing again. Yes, said Risei, her face going scarlet, and I'll be wearing it so that I can focus all my attention on you three. I only have the one. Now strip. Jean stopped laughing. Excuse me? Strip, I mean you. You're going to be one of the biggest bulls I've ever seen, and we have to attach a lot of equipment to you. Now move. Jean stripped with bad grace. I turned away, and I heard Jeff making gagging noises. Jean naked. Surely nothing ahead of us could be that bad. By evening, I had already grown to loathe being a cow. Risei's transformation worked a little too accurately. The forest troll had turned into an enraged bull, but that was because trolls are big and the natural state for a troll is enraged. When we transformed, Jean was a mountainous bull and looked even bigger with our covert sack stuffed under his belly. Jeff was a wiry little bull, just like he was a wiry little man. As for Risei and myself, we were, of course, not bulls, and my udders hadn't been milked all day. They throbbed. It hadn't taken us long to run across the first gamekeeper riding on his horse, so we'd been in our bovine forms since late morning, being driven back to Overdark's Manor, prodded by sticks and nipped at by dogs. I was concerned about the gamekeeper. He looked just a little bit too alert. I hoped he wouldn't notice anything odd about Jean's truly sagging belly, an enchanted pouch that held our equipment, but I couldn't see it, and Risei's skills with cows were impressive. He had, however, ripped the silver cowbell from Risei's neck the instant he'd noticed it. Are you okay? I asked her. It came out as but the enchantment she used allowed us to understand one another. Oh, she replied. This filtered through my consciousness as, I think so. As long as I'm not too distracted, don't talk to me. I nodded and got whacked between the shoulders again. We were approaching the cattle pen as the sun set. The gamekeeper kicked his horse forward, approaching one of the sentries. What's the story, Edja? Found these 4 wild cows up at the north road, adding them to the herd. The sentry laughed raucously. Some fellas get all the luck. His lordship will thank you. Aye. 2 large cattlemen stepped up and ushered us forward as the gamekeeper rode off. I was tired. I paid little attention until we stopped in front of the pen. I smelled hot metal. What was happening didn't even register until I heard Jeff's bray of protest. What the fuck? He screamed. Smoke was rising from the brand on Jeff's hindquarters. A flanged circle split down the middle, superimposed on an M rune. Jeff turned on the cattleman with blood in his eyes. I would have been laughing, but the thought of facing that hot iron made my stomachs, all 4 of them, fall away. You didn't say anything about being branded, I cried. In the background, I heard a nervous moo from Jean to Jeff that translated as, Jeff, save it for later. Later? Snorting and with the prods of the cattlemen leveled at him, the wiry bull that was Jeff backed down. Well, I grunted. Rise looked frightened. Shut up, she waffled. It's going to hurt, and I have to concentrate. He took my amulet. I felt sick. If they branded her and she lost concentration. I had a sudden vision of us all changing back to human form, naked and unarmed, on the manor of Baron Overdark. It was a very short vision. Then agony bit into my side, and I twisted away. Flesh and hair burned. That's gotcha, grunted the brander as he slapped me on the burned spot. Take him! We were led away. We were still cows. You did good, I said to Rise. Thanks, her tone was distant. We joined a small river of cattle streaming into the pen. So what does the brand mean? The slashed circle is an O and a D for House Overdark, she mooed. The M rune is his name, Mizar. We were in the pen, and I stepped over to close to Jean. I didn't want to be naked for longer than I had to be. How was your branding? I asked conversationally. The sun was almost down. We should just need a couple of more hours. Something's wrong, Jean said, and I looked up, suddenly very nervous. His tone was hoarse and frightened. What is it? I don't know, he said. Right after the brand, I felt... His voice went silent, cut off suddenly. Rise, I called. Gashing a few of my fellow cattle, I turned just in time to see Rise's flank disappear behind a wall of living, breathing beef. For just an instant, I'd had a good look at her. There was no brand. I whipped my head back around and looked at the nearest cow, looking for the brand. There wasn't one. Rise, I called, but she was gone. I turned. Jeff, where's Rise? Jean can't speak. Something's wrong. He snorted, yeah, there'll be something wrong with that bitch when I get my hands on her, letting my ass get burned that way. He'll be fine when we change back. Pipe down. I tried to calm down, but something wouldn't let me. I turned, looking for another cow with the flanged circle brand. Sir, surely there had to be one. I sighed in relief. There was a large bull right beside me. On his flank was one of the flanged circles. I gave a soft moo. Boy, am I glad to see you, big fellow. Slowly, the big bull's head turned. The stupid eyes seemed to try for focus. He bellowed softly, and I heard words. Lady, get out. Nice lady, go before too late. Run, help. My hooves were rooted to the ground. Who are... The huge beast looked agonized with the pressure of remembering. Me, eight, fire, para... The bullowing turned animal. No more words. I looked around frantically. Rise? No answer. I was penned in by on all sides by cattle, and three men were striding through them, towards us, towards Jean. In a smooth motion, one of them drew his sword and sliced low into Jean's belly. The skin split. Cloaks and mail spilled onto the ground. My arrows and bows, Jeff's sword, Jean's staff. The shortest man stepped up and behind the others and threw off his hood. Her hood. Rise, I lowed, but she wore an evil grin. Keep this one for breeding, she said, slapping Jean on the rump. If there's any who'll give us some especially fat beef, it's him. I've stupefied him for an hour or so. You'll have no trouble. She'll be a good milk cow once you pin her, she finished, gesturing to me. I bellowed in protest, lowering my horns, but Jean absent-mindedly stepped in my path and I couldn't move him. I heard Jeff's squeal of rage. Bitch, he shrieked. I'll fuck you up. He lowered his head and bellowed in frustration as four other cows lumbered over and bracketed him, leaving him no room to move. He slashed at them as best he could with his horns, but could cause no more than scratches. I don't think so, Rise said. In fact, I've made sure you won't do that ever again. Boys, take this steer over to the slaughterhouse. For sure he won't breed. She leered at him, and he was never very good at it anyway. Suddenly, a rope settled over my shoulders. I bucked, trying to get it off, but as a cow, I was so heavy. The rope stayed in place as it fastened, and it hurt. I locked eyes with Rise, imagining what I'd do when I transformed back. She looked at me, weighing. If you didn't hate me as you do, I might be open to a deal with you. You're good with that bow, and you did try to stop Jeff from gutting me. I owe you one. My heart leaped. Of course, I also owe you one for exposing me in the first place. Her tone turned dark. Your new accommodations are a little cramped, but you'll forget to care about that soon. Chad hardly minds at all now, and he's been here a week. The rune you were branded with makes the spell permanent, the nullification symbol over the M for man. When I get back, I'll test you. If you still have a mind at all, perhaps I'll take you on as my apprentice cowgirl. I'd require some fairly strong oaths on your part, stronger than in that magical contract. You'd like that, wouldn't you, compared to the alternative? I nodded as best I could. The rope tugged irresistibly. A haze seemed to descend. Far off, I heard Rise's voice. Good, take her away and don't hurt her. 4 head of cattle at 10 gold a head. That's the agreement. See to my horse. I've got a long ride back to the inn tomorrow if I'm to pick up some more head. The stall is cramped, and I'm not sure how long I've been here. I've been milked a couple of times, and it's hard to keep focused on anything. The grass is sweet. I wonder how long it is until Rise comes back. Moo. Okay. Well, I'm now going to go ahead to the story that, let's see, yeah. I'm going to go ahead to the story that Karen Joy Fowler just bought for her Moda anthology, which comes after comes out in September and is available at bookstores everywhere, and not just in Australia. Hurrah. And hopefully this will be a bit of a transition from the ridiculous to the sublime. The title of this story is When the Fleet Comes. My wife turns gently beside me in the dark warmth of our bed. The smooth rippling of her fine scales against the skin of my arm and side are enough to bring me fully awake. I open my eyes to the wan light of the sun through the dim glass. In these shadows, it is all but impossible to tell our skins apart. Blue-gray scale and pinkish-tan skin blur together in the middle of the otherwise photorealistic wash that is our bedroom. I am awake completely. It's a trick I've always had. Ajna wakes more slowly and later, so I'm careful as I roll out of the bed and walk into the kitchen on my toes. This walk is something I've learned from a lifetime of being around Hredin. I can't do it while wearing shoes, of course. In public, I'm confined to the flat, heel-toe gait of humans. But at home or in private company, I come to my toes without thinking. I've surprised many Hredin that way. They've told me so. I go to work an hour before Ajna does. It's already 1500 morning. I shower and dress quickly. A look through the refrigerator provides me with the last slice of a PU flank, which I wrap with a length of leaf. Harsh green and blood flavors mix. No human can be a connoisseur among the Hredin, nor can one survive without some vegetable matter. I'm just wiping my mouth when I hear Ajna step into the kitchen behind me. She's smiling at me, but her pointed teeth and deep compound eyes are only half showing. Ajna is not a morning person. She grips her night cloak with all 8 fingers, as if it is sleep itself that she can hold on to. Her bright red crests are folded back against her scalp. She stretches in a yawn, arching her narrow spine. Good morning, I say to her. Big day today? She scratches an eye. Not as big as for you. Happy Fleet Day, Sean. Now she smiles wider. She draws from the pocket of her cloak a small bauble and hands it to me. My stomach knots and I feel my face grow hard as I take it. It's a little thing. A ball of glass surrounding another ball of blue-painted ocean with continents picked out on green. On almost invisible supports, 2 large blocky battleships slowly orbit the model planet. In transparent red Latin letters are the English words, When the Fleet Comes. I consciously ease on my grip on the thing. You're not serious, I hear myself say, fighting a storm that threatens to spill over my mind and out through my lips. Ajna's crests flare. She senses that I'm troubled but doesn't know why. Why not? It's an official holiday now. I know only the human bureaucrats get off work, but it's your holiday all the same. The bottom is emptying out of the world. Is that how you think of it? Well, you don't talk about it much, so I can't say it's our holiday, but I don't talk about it at all. I'm surprised at my own vehemence. I'm squeezing the ornament again. This is not mine. I don't spend one day of the year crying for Earth or making those horrible attempts at music or poisoning myself in the streets until I vomit all because of a dead world. There are no tears in Ajna's eyes. There cannot be, but her face is closed and withdrawn in sorrow. But not for herself. No, you don't, she says. Perhaps it's time you did. What? I can't believe what I'm hearing. I look desperately at the clock, 1550. I don't have time to discuss this. I have to go. I'll be late. I love you. Goodbye, Sean, she says sadly. She turns away, walking toward the bathroom. I'm left holding the ornament. I give it a last hateful look and then walk out the door. On the way down the hall to the elevator, I drop it in the trash can. Down on the ground, the streets of Dreodan are less than half full as I walk to the maglev station. Aliens going about their daily lives. I wince at the thought. Aliens. People I've known or might have known all my life. My adopted people and beautiful, silver-gray, finely scaled skins, large, sensitive compound eyes, crests of red, purple, gold. They walk on their toes and the balls of their feet. Long ago, when I was a child, I saw human women at a party unconsciously trying to imitate that walk by using shoes set with long posts at the heels. They were not half so graceful. I am Hredin, by choice, not by birth. I speak Plia better than I speak English, for all that my walk is flat and I have hair on my head and smooth, light, tan skin. I don't think about it any more than I think about my inability to see ultraviolet. And my wife, whom I love, has just reminded me violently that I am an alien on her planet. I press my identity ring up against the gate and climb the shallow steps to the train platform. Ugly suspicions begin to flit around in my head. Perhaps it is time you did. What did Ashna really mean? We married later in life than most people. I was 20 years old, although one of my few human friends had insisted me in sending me a card commemorating my 30th birthday. Why anyone measures Earth years anymore baffles me. They're only about two-thirds as long as a Hredin year. Ashna was 21. We were content with each other and didn't want children. We discussed that problem in detail before we were married. She changed her mind? She could, of course. Of all the women in the world, Ashna could do that. Hredin made for life. When a couple first experiences intercourse, their pheromones imprint on one another, making sexual relations with another literally impossible. But I was human. Imprinting would not occur. Her egg brother had reminded me of that in a private corner of at our wedding, his teeth slightly bared, just short of the white smile that invited a fight. "So, Cheyenne," Dishna had said, mangling my name on purpose, "it seems you have won her, for a while at least." I felt my eyes narrow. Marriage was for life, everyone knew that. Our marriage vows had not been changed because of my biology. What did he mean? He read the question even out of my alien eyes. "When she comes to her senses, I will be there." Many would consider that this is not a marriage at all, no matter what has been said. And he had whirled away, crests flat with frustration. I knew he was telling the truth, and as a lawyer, he probably knew just which people would have to consider it so to make it true. Ajna had been furious when she'd learned of it. Egg siblings were close, but Dishna had been grossly out of line, or so she had said then. Does she still think so now? Why would she remind me of this annual madness that the humans down in their quarters celebrate, or suggest that I join them? I shudder. The train has arrived. It hovers in the pit. I join my fellow passengers in stepping aboard. A few polite smiles flicker between us. Everything seems more detailed, more important today than on any day before this. Is that contempt I see in my neighbor's eyes, the way he stands there, tall in his winter coat and work skirt, orange crests spread wide in the morning air? Two women whisper together with scaled lips, and I nearly glare at them. Are they talking about me? Tell myself I'm being ridiculous. I didn't think like this yesterday, especially about Ajna. Why would she deliberately hurt me? There are two other aliens in the car. One is a mountain of hair. I don't recognize the species, but then Dreodan is a starport city. The other is human. Short, shorter than me. He smiles nervously at me, a big human smile with the corners of his mouth touching his ears. He takes a couple of steps toward me, even as I will him to remain where he is.
Вы, конечно, не говорите по-русски.
It sounds like someone asking for something he knows he won't get. I don't look at him as I answer, in Plia. Don't understand. Sorry.
It is nothing,
he says in the same tongue, heavily accented as the maglev stops, but his face falls. A lonely look. He says something that sounds like, Когда флота вернется, and leaves. I am finally able to wrap my confusion and worry into a combination of counting stations and wondering what language the human had used. I manage to keep my mind on my work for the rest of the day. I do this until I notice the clock reads 3600. It's time to go home, to Ajna, to my wife whose ornament lies in a wastebasket on the floor of our building, and whose meaning lies hidden. I've closed down my terminal and I'm walking toward the maglev station. Tell myself again that I'm overreacting. I know Ajna. She loves me. She has never suggested that she considered marrying a human a mistake or anything different from marrying a Hredin. Until now. I hesitate at the station gates, identity ring half raised. Silver gray, finely scaled people move around me, like water around a stubborn rock. I decide that I need time to think. I will walk to the next station and then go home. The streets are cold and not very crowded, yet not as cold as they might be. Dreodan is sufficiently north not to be troubled by severe winters, and the buildings block the wind, the mountains don't. I've nearly decided what I will say to Ajna when I hear the shouts, high voices yelling. I quicken my stride and turn the corner. I stop. A severe gray building looks out over the brown dust of a schoolyard fenced in by a low rim of glass steel. Old plastic poles and exercise equipment litter the hard ground. And in the middle, three children surrounding a smaller one lying on the ground. "You want some more of this, you piece of shit?" yells one of them. "What's that? I didn't hear you." The smallest of those standing punctuates his words with a kick. His victim moans and the other two laugh. I freeze, mouth going dry in spite of my age. There were never enough places to run in the corridors of a human life ship. No place for children cramped in the small rooms to escape without incurring the wrath of the spacers. Grim men prematurely aged by helplessness and defeat, leading what was left of the human race to some other place in the giant shells that crept along just barely faster than light. I'd almost gotten away that time. I was now faster than Vlad and his cronies could have believed. If only the grate had held that I had not fallen practically in the middle of them. Dazed by the impact in the full G of the outer shell, I could do nothing as Vlad released a high braying laugh. "Damn, it be raining fat boy pieces of shit today." And then it was all fists and blood and crying. I stopped when I realized it was only me, that they had left, still laughing. When I presented myself to Mr. Johnson, the graying director of the children's corridor, he shook his head. As he went to get some disinfected, he muttered, "No goddamn wonder we lost the war." 3 months later, we landed on Hredin. No human family had money to spare for another child. I was raised in an orphanage, learning the language and getting used to 40-hour days on my own. With no other humans, the Hredin children nicknamed me Happy because they couldn't understand why I was. The memory comes out of dark places, and before I know it, I vaulted over the wall, my 24-year-old legs nearly buckling as I land. "That's enough! Get off him right now!" My voice surprises me, somewhere in the dim distance where surprise matters. The attackers straighten as if shot, compound eyes glittering fear and hatred. My blood pounds, 9 years old probably, just about the time Hredin starts to get dangerous. "Shit, it's another one," one of them mutters. "Who says it's enough, rat face?" says the leader, sneering, teeth bared. His head comes to my neck. He's tensed for combat. The others are nearly my height. I feel my own lips pull back at the racial insult, and then I'm no longer there. As if I'm controlling a puppet, I make myself step forward and backhand him across the jaw. He snarls and leaps. I bury my left fist in his nose and he falls back. I look around wildly, raising my arms and flinching from the blows I know are coming from either side, but the nearly silent pads of running feet make me look up. The two bigger boys are running for the fence. I look down. The boy I've hit whimpers and shakes his head, then scrambles to his feet and runs, leaving a violet stain from his flat, bleeding nose in the dirt. A long, shuddering breath leaves me. I reach down to the remaining boy, huddled beneath his winter coat. He flinches slightly at my touch. I reach for his hand. 5 pale fingers grip my wrist. My God. The words leave me as I look into the face of a human boy. Blood runs from a cut on his lip. He's perhaps 7 years old. Pale skin, eyes that look slightly tilted somehow, dark curly hair. He looks up into my eyes as if I am something outside his experience. "Thank you," he chokes out in English. "You saved me. They said there were people like you, but I never..." He trails off, unsure how to continue. "You speak English?" "I understand," I reply in the same language, almost without realizing it. I'm more concerned with his words. "People like you. Human vigilantes, perhaps?" "I would have done the same for anyone," I say, probably too defensively. "You all right?" "I've had worse," the boy says glumly, then brightens. "Who are you?" "I'm Sean," I say. "What's your name?" "I'm Youngjun Tomlinson," says the boy. "I don't think I've ever heard anyone mention you." "I doubt we know many of the same people," I say in as neutral a tone as possible. "You live outside the quarter, don't you?" Youngjun eyes me suspiciously as though I might suddenly grow antennae. "Yes," I smile grimly, "and you live inside it." He turns to go, and I remember the times I had to walk home alone, not knowing who might have retreated just ahead of me, ready to strike again. I sigh. "Why don't I walk you home, Youngjun? After all, it isn't that far to the quarter. I'll call Ajna and tell her what happened." "All right," smiles Youngjun. He leads me down to the side streets to another avenue. The sun is setting. "This happen a lot?" I ask softly. "Enough," he mutters. "They think humans take their jobs and shit, and they don't like the way we look. My dad says if they weren't so butt-lazy, they'd keep the jobs themselves. My dad says at least they don't have to worry about us marrying their daughters." He laughs quietly, and I am glad the lengthening shadows hide my flushed face. We are now in the human quarter. There's no line of demarcation, save that the apartment buildings and houses have grown steadily shabbier. Stains mark the walls. Here and there, a rectangular building squats among the triangles. A few of the charitable groups that had helped build these projects actually consulted human architects, or at least the residents. Colored lights begin to peep out the windows. Occasional singing drifts from stood doorways, both recorded and actual voices. And smells, strange smells, tickling the back of my mind. And now I am here, in the quarter, going to a house that is most likely celebrating Fleet Day. I think of the ornament shoved in the trash can, and a feeling of subtle dread steals over me. The lighted windows seem walls, forcing me onward, permitting turns neither to the right nor to the left. Yongjun turns a corner, and we come to a small, squat building, a square. Yongjun's parents must be better off than usual to afford a room here. We go down some stairs, and Yongjun raps on the door. It opens quickly. A girl stands there, looking down on Yongjun. She's about 12, dressed in black, wearing a loose shirt and the long, nearly form-fitting tubes that humans call pants. Her long red hair falls down past her shoulders. "It's about time you got here," she says to Yongjun. "Mom and Dad are worried about you." She calls back into the house. "He's here, Dad!" Then she looks up and sees me. Her eyes, blue but tilted just like Yongjun's, go wide. "Hi," she says to me, and a nervous smile spreads over her face. My breath catches. She turns away. "Dad, you'd better come see this." A tall, thin-faced man, over 30 by the look of him, hurries in. A worried face peers out from under light red hair. "Yes, what is it? What's wrong? Yongjun, are you all right?" He sees me. "Who are you?" Before I can answer, Yongjun jumps in. "This is Sean, Dad. He helped me get away from those snakes I've been telling you about. He's from outside the quarter." "Really?" Yongjun's father looks the question at me. I wince. Snakes. I've seen the term before, scrawled on walls, but this is the first time I've actually heard someone use it. The human counter to rat face. I feel unclean. "There are a few Hredin involved." "Yes," I say. "Your son was facing unfair odds. I'd have done the same." "Oh, you must think I'm rude to question you like this at the door," Tom Lunson breaks in. "My apologies, sir. Do come in." He stands out of the way. "Your mother wants to speak to you, young man." Yongjun's face falls, and he disappears into the next room as if facing doom itself. I step into the house, and the smell overwhelms me. It is meat, but not meat. Not the raw flesh I'm used to, but hot, and there are other smells too. Vegetables? Hot food? It is like something out of the deep past, but very different. Only after this do I notice the room. It's small, perhaps half the size of my own living room. Deep brown carpet covers the floor. I can see the kitchen off to the left. A small multicom is on low volume in the opposite corner, flashing images obscured by white noise. An old set. A dark hallway leads to the right. Tomlinson ushers me in. His daughter returns to her place in a chair opposite the multicom. She watches me. I am watching the tree. Earth life. It dominates the room, set against one wall. It is a foot taller than I myself, head height for an adult male Hredin. It is composed entirely of dark green needles. Hung on the needles are ornaments, gold and red balls, wreaths, and much more. Near the front is a model of a human cruiser, its running lights flashing. Fiber optics flash on and off, a galaxy of colors through the tree. At the top of the tree is a globe with familiar markings, a misshapen green horse leaping from a mountain balanced on its tip. Earth. Above all this is a yellow banner with red felt letters, "When the Fleet Comes." Looking more closely now, I can see that it is not a tree at all, but a metal skeleton with plastic needles. A very good recreation. "You like our tree, do you, sir?" says Tomlinson. "A very old heirloom, that, from Earth itself. Used to be a Christmas tree in my boyhood and in my father's." Christmas. I vaguely remember Christmas. Scattered images of excitement and good. "It's very nice," I say absently. Now I see that not all the ornaments have something to do with Fleet Day. One is a piece of wood carved to resemble a hoop of leaves. In the middle turns a fat, red-bearded figure. Another, so old that I can barely make out the design. A town covered in snow, all the buildings square. Above the town, so large it must be false, shines a cross-shaped star. The hills around the town were not covered in snow or green. Whole hills of green. "This one's mine," announces Yongjun from around my waist, reaching up to hold a paper ornament. I take it from him gently. Two human silhouetted faces, obviously male and female, look outward. Between them, colored in green and blue crayon, is the earth. I hand it back to Yongjun and feel a sting in my thumb. A cut almost too thin to see oozes a single drop of dark red blood. "Yongjun is our artist," says a new voice in a strangely slurred English. I look up. A short woman with olive skin, almond eyes, and long black hair is looking at me with a smile on her face. She's actually sweating. Mrs. Tomlinson, I presume. Indeed, Mr. Yeranhijor. Sean Yeranhijor. Just Sean, I say, noticing the strange looks I'm getting. That's a Fredin surname, said Mr. Tomlinson guardedly. Well, actually, it's my... I hesitate. My wife's name, I am about to say. But I remember Jungjun's comment about snakes and his father's failure to call him to task for it. My legal name. For ease of pronunciation, I say, and feel like a traitor. Ease, laughs the girl. What do you call yourself when you want to confuse people? For Fredin, it's easy. You're most welcome to our house, Sean, says Mrs. Tomlinson. I'm Young Ai. This is my husband George and my daughter Amanda. You know Jungjun already. Please stay and share the Fleet Day meal with us. Yeah, says Jungjun. Both George and Amanda smile encouragingly at me. The smells from the kitchen are singing in my brain, and Ajna isn't home. I'll have to call my wife, I say, and wonder who spoke. Is this me about to sit down with humans to a Fleet Day dinner? This stupid holiday devoted to wishful thinking? Or is it my stomach overriding my brain? The phone is here, Young A says, handing it to me. I dial. Hello? Hi, Ajna, I manage. Sean, I was beginning to worry. Where are you? You aren't still mad about this morning, are you? No, of course not, I say, keeping my voice low. Another wave of shame passes through me. It is too late to back out. I can tell her what I was about to do. She'll understand. But it will mean admitting she was right to give me that ornament and involve lengthy explanation. Perhaps it is time you did. Is this what she meant by that? I have to work late. I'll be back before midnight. I love you. I love you, Sean. There is a pause. Goodbye. I switch off the phone. It is, to my knowledge, the first time I have ever lied to my wife. The family is waiting at the table for me, and the heat emanating from it is like nothing I've ever experienced. Covered dishes are everywhere. Steam is rising from some of them. The smells coming from them are pieces of dreams and memories and forgotten warmth made strange by space and time. I approach and we sit together. Then George rises and holds up a bottle. He rises and steps toward me, unsealing it. Into a small glass beside the mug of water, he pours a reddish-purple liquid. I barely stop myself from recoiling as the smell hits me. Alcohol. Of course, alcohol, the slow metabolic poison that humans take. It will kill a Hredin. The glass is full and I tremble. They will drink this red death and expect me to do so as well. I remind myself violently that I am human. George reseals the bottle after pouring a very small amount for Jungjun. Then he lifts his glass. To our unexpected but most welcome guest, Sean. Truly a blessing and a gift on this Fleet Day. Maybe he will be remembered and blessed when the fleet comes. When the fleet comes, they respond, and I find myself muttering the response a half step behind them. They drink, looking at me. I drink. I recognize it. Gunberry, but not as sweet. The bitterness of the aftertaste hits me, and I force myself not to grimace. They drink this on purpose? Then I feel fingers of warmth spreading upwards from my stomach into my arms. Against my will, I find myself relaxing. And the sooner the fleet comes, the better. I hear George murmur under his breath. I see Young Ai nod. Do they really believe it? I cannot tell from the expressions on their faces. No. Admiral Anasazawi's message notwithstanding, the fleet must be dead by now. The fleet. Barely one undersized task force, I remember hearing a spacer mutter. All the ships that couldn't get home in time for the last battle, and the old, old man who led them, saying in a broken voice, I shall return. Perhaps with no more Earth lift to give their lives for, the Admiral had tried to give the life ships hope. Perhaps they found what happiness can still be found for humans with no adopted worlds. I find myself hoping that, at least, even though I've spared no thought for the fleet or humans at all in years. Amanda breaks into my thoughts. Were you really speaking Pleiad to your wife? I look at Amanda. She faces me with cool, smiling eyes, waiting for my answer. My wife does not speak English, I say. Again, I'm ashamed, but less strongly than before. God help me, am I becoming accustomed to this? Has Ajna ever spoken of me this way to others? I know a chap with that problem, says George. Married a girl from Arabia. Spoke no English at all. Get along all right in Pleiad, though. Doesn't matter to the kids, of course. Both Jungjun and Amanda speak perfect Korean, so their mother tells me. Can't understand a word myself. The dishes are passed around the table and we serve ourselves. Almost all of it is unrecognizable to me. I haven't thought of cooking food since childhood. They tell me the names of the dishes in their English and Korean equivalents. Roast turkey, calamari, glass noodles, kimchi. I remember kimchi because after the first bite, I'm forced to drain my entire glass of water. It's like acid. Young Jun giggles at me and Amanda suppresses a grin. So what exactly happened to make you follow my little brother home, Sean? Asks Amanda, eyes flashing. Well, I begin and I'm grateful to Young Jun, who leaps in, starting from the very beginning and ending triumphantly with me vaulting the fence like a mythical hero and destroying his tormentors with the sheer force of my superior human wrath. Amanda rolls her eyes through her brother's story, and I am caught up in the meaning of that expression, irises and pupils moving like sparks under her dark lashes. Pradeen eyes do not move. Hers move back to me. I sort of meant, what were you doing there, Sean? She gives her brother a sharp look. I was just taking a walk, killing some time after work. I was still very brave to do what you did. I hear those snake kids around that place carry knives. I wince at the epithet. The Fredin, I stress gently, say the same about humans. Indeed, says Young Ai. In this neighborhood, that is often the truth. Our young people, they believe a blade settles many things that unsettle them. She glances at her daughter. So do theirs. Of course, you might not know this, Sean, living where you do. She says it in a flat, calm voice, and I realize the line has been drawn. A barrier beyond which I may not cross. Here's well, I'm almost accepted, not quite an alien. Besides which, she's right. I do not know these people. They've isolated themselves from my world, closing themselves off. Or did I close them off? Or is it a thing that simply must be? The grease from the fried calamari starts to congeal in my stomach, separating into parts. Do you and your wife have any children? George asks me. He looks at me with a peculiar intensity. No, I say as expressionlessly as possible. My wife can't have children. Not with me, anyway. Never with me. Ah, oh, that's a shame, he says, chewing his turkey. But not uncommon in these days, he sighs. I can guess what he means. Quite a few humans are sterile. Some life ships took near misses from nuclear weapons. I say nothing. The conversation drifts to other things and runs from discussions of the neighbors to jobs to things I don't remember. I'm mostly absorbed in the food. Amanda grins at me when I stumble over the names of the dishes. For dessert, Young Ai brings out a loaf of fresh bread of a kind I've never seen before. It's light, like foam, not dry and flat. She then brings out a jar filled with a red miasma of dark shapes. The faded label says, strawberry jam. My mouth goes dry. It is a name I vaguely remember and a taste I've long forgotten, kept safe for almost 17 years. It is beyond price. Even I understand that there are no words for such a moment. Straining, the lines coming hard to her smooth face, Young Ai cracks the vacuum seal and spreads the jam on 5 slices of bread. The flavor is almost too much. Childhood and dim shapes that I recognize vaguely as my parents coalesce around the fresh red sweetness. Through half-lidded eyes, I see George and Young Ai also locked in memory. More memory for them, they're older. Amanda and Young Jun chew quietly, faces smooth with solemnity. They understand the reasons, but not the feel. Not even Amanda could have been born on Earth. After the meal, conversation continues in the living room until I remember that Ajna is waiting. Guiltily, I look at my watch. It is 4500, past time to go. And I do not want to leave. It is like a dream that has become more and more real. I find myself wondering why in my youth I did not allow myself to be pulled into the quarter, into the lower classes, where I so easily could have belonged, completely and totally, here beneath the notice of the gods or riches they do not have. I could have been George's co-worker, Young Ai's husband, Young Jun's father. I feel as if I've just been told for the first time that I'm blind and that other people can see. Young Ai and Young Jun start to clear away the dishes. Amanda and George rise. Come into the living room, Sean, says George, and I'll give you the grand tour such as it is. Amanda gives a strangled gasp and blushes, running down the hall to shut her door. There isn't much to see. The apartment's tiny. The furniture is all Hredin. Shipping the Christmas tree must have claimed nearly all the Tomlinson's baggage space. Young Jun makes a whirlwind appearance and tries to explain the significance of every piece of matter in his bedroom, but George stops him. The tour takes less than 10 minutes. Back in the living room, George excuses himself to go help his wife. A cool hand rests on my shoulder. I turn to meet Amanda's smile. Come with me, she says, taking me by the hand. Let me show you the garden. Garden? She gives a low, deprecating laugh. Well, we call it that, anyway. Sounds better than big flower pots on the patio. She slides open the glass door on the far wall of the room. It is dark outside. Mist swirls in and out of the spotlight that illuminates the tiny outdoor space in the center of the building. Three other apartments face a lawn of bluish moss crossed by a pavement and a bench. On either side of the porch are two large tubs of dirt. One is bare, the other is studded with thick wisps of green. Grass? Onions, Amanda says. They're pretty hardy. You can even grow them now. Look. She digs her hand into the soft loam of the other tub and comes up with a nightmare ovoid, brown, scaly, and horned. Potatoes, she says, meeting my puzzled eyes. Real potatoes, you know? I did, but could only stare. Well, they're almost like gold here. They'll even grow in winter. With those and the onions, it's almost like Dad having two jobs. And you leave them out here? Her eyes darken. You don't steal Earth life. Ever. No one steals Earth life. Damn sure no one steals it twice. She hands the thing to me and laughs softly when I hesitate. It's warm. We have to heat the tubs a little, she says. Come on, I'll show you how to put it back. She kneels beside me and her hands close around mine, holding them in the potato. Warmth more than simple heat can account for flows through my hands, spreading. Amanda spreads her fingers and parts the loose black dirt, nestling the potato in our hands into it. Sometimes I like to come out here and put my hands and feet in the dirt, she murmurs. I feel like I could take root myself like a tree if there still were any. The dirt is warm and damp around our hands. Slowly she disengages, reaches behind her. I follow her movements, and she brings out a pair of cups, newly polished stone and a bottle, her dirt-encrusted hands arranging them as if by right, a quasi-mythical being from dead stories. She turns and blinks at me with her astonishingly mobile blue eyes. She's in her element, and she's beautiful. Push the thought away, but it will not be wholly silent. She continues, pouring a golden liquid into the cups. I've never seen this kind of beauty before. She hands me a cup and raises her own. When the fleet comes, she says. Now I can hear the sardonic tone of her voice. I raise my cup and the smell of alcohol burns through my nose. I almost sneeze. How much can I drink before the poison starts to work? In any case, there's no more of this than there was of the wine, and I feel no effect. She notices my hesitation. When the fleet comes, I say, the aliens will be fucked, she answers, as if completing the sentence. Then she laughs as if it's some joke and drains half the cup. I drink and then splutter, breaking into a dry cough. This is liquid fire. It burns in my stomach and I wince, but Amanda is still laughing. I try to cover my distress. She raises her cup to mine and drinks, motioning for me to do the same. This time the alcohol is in my mouth before I even think about it. It is easier this time, smoother. Something else today was easier the second time I did it, but I'm not sure anymore what it was. Ajna's words float past me. Perhaps it is time you did, and a wave of anger hits me. Maybe she was right. Maybe I will show her she was right. Perhaps this is what she meant. I take another swallow of the burning liquid, and my cup is empty. She raises the bottle and leans toward me. Our noses are nearly touching now. Her breath is a memory of flowers and wine and everything that ought to have been. A spinning flame seems to be just out of sight. Amanda, I say, and then our hands entwine, flaking dirt, and her scent rushes in on me, and there is nothing but our two mouths locked together, and time slows to a crawl, impeded by the clumsy movements of our fingers, a pleasure rising almost to pain. Our mouths break apart for breath, and she fumbles for it with my skirt. Like a bomb, the knowledge bursts in on me that we are about to do the impossible. No Hredin can do what I'm about to do, and that secret rushes to my face in a snarl of joy, and Amanda somehow catches it and smiles herself as she loosens her shirt, transcending and transcendently human. Her eyes flare blue under their strange tilt, her father's eyes, and that thought shatters the moment like a spike of ice as I remember exactly where we are. What's the matter, Sean? Amanda murmurs as I hold up a hand and look wildly back at the glass door. It is vacant except for the lights of the tree. My breathing returns to something approaching normal. What's the matter? I reply stupidly. My God, your father, I mean, can't, not here in the yard. She looks puzzled. You think he doesn't know? He, it is as if my tongue has been turned to wood. If it hadn't been my idea anyway, I'm sure he would have suggested it, she goes on. Lots of women have already had two children at 18 Earth years. She pauses. really like my first to be yours, Sean. My romantic illusions and my lust collapse.
But why?
I manage. She sits back, looking at me quizzically. Why? You're from far outside the quarter, aren't you, Sean? She gestures to the empty streets. Take a look around you. You don't think a decent man would marry a girl who hasn't had at least one healthy child, do you? My chances are probably better than you with you than with anyone else. Don't you want children, Sean? A child of my own. Is this what she's offering me? What Ajna and I gave up so long ago? Ajna and I. The thought hits like a fist. Amanda, I'm married. I cannot say it. Shame rolls over me at what I was about to do. I have to go. She does not say a word as I rise and pull aside the door. Except for the tree and a solitary lamp, the living room is dark. I have to wait for my eyes to adjust to find the door. I whirl as George steps into the room from the kitchen. Fear contracts in my gut as I throw my hands up, trying to stammer something. You didn't take very long, Sean. He just stands there, watching me matter-of-factly. I'm not angry with you, Sean, just a little disappointed. It's the first time, at least, I think so, and you might have been a little more gentle. It's not like you think. She told me you knew. We didn't. Now he narrows his eyes. You didn't? Why not? He takes a step toward me. Not good enough for you high-class uptown types, Sean. Is that what you're saying? Now he looks very dangerous. Oh, no, it's not that at all. It's just that, damn it, George, I'm married. You know that. What would your wife say if... Once again, shame almost drives me to my knees at how close I've come. George gets the same puzzled look that his daughter had worn. My wife is fertile. He looks down. Sorry, that was badly put. But you did tell us yourself your wife couldn't have children. She's got no exclusive right to you. And what's the harm in your giving Amanda a good start? George, you don't understand. Among my wife's people, you just don't. George's face hardens, but there's sympathy in his eyes. Look, Sean, this is no time for old customs. We want to keep as many as we can alive, but that won't matter if there's no one left to remember them, will it? He takes me by the shoulders. This is what we have to do to survive. What humans have to do. What we have to do, I repeat. Even if we betray our words? To survive? Survive as what, George? Survive at all for a start. He looks away. Look, your wife doesn't ever have to know. Amanda's husband will raise your son as his own. But if she did know, she would have to understand. You don't know Ajna, I began, and stop. George pushes me away as if I've burned him. Ajna, he repeats, looking at me in disbelief. Ajna? My God, that's not a Redeem name. It's a question, but he reads the answer out of my face. That's where you got that last name of yours. You married a Redeem. His face flushes dark. You son of a bitch, you'll kill us all and for nothing. George, I out! Get out of my house, he yells. Get out and don't come back, you perverted bastard. He advances. I run for the door, leaping from the porch as it slams behind me. I run for a long time, the world becoming a blur. By the time I stop, the square houses are behind me, and the triangles of Dreyudan are coming into view. Thank you. Okay. Well, that's almost it, but I think that what they're going to post on the website, because of publishers' wonderful contractual obligations of what you can't print where at the same time, is this poem, which I'll just read as the conclusion. And it's called Why I Still Watch Star Wars. We drift in the dim hall of mostly space, on the dark side of the force, flowing through us, binding us in these scarce, padded cinema chairs that protect us from the ineffable thrust that strings the stars like dust in momentary cobwebs, pulling us into the other dimension. I've got a bad feeling about this. There's something alive in here, and Han Solo was right when he said, "It's your imagination, kid." So many parts of America and childhood swirled and spiraled in, now with a long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. Or maybe it's just sitting beside you, speculating. You think a princess and a guy like me? Lines ricochet between shadows, ghosts of dreams, and what I want to say. You mean you've never heard of the Millennium Falcon? Should you have? Only if you want to feel as I do. Because otherwise, what a piece of junk it is. When a little boy, his old man, and their god save the world, and I grin. Ridiculous it may be, but when I ask in the sunset, has it been otherwise? It is just this that keeps me standing, staring quickly cross-eyed at the horizon until I see me under two suns in a desert sky, waiting for stars. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. Are there any questions?
If there's any cue, I'll try to give as much A as I can.
where did the inspiration for bovine intervention come from?
A number of people that the names have been changed to protect the not so innocent. As I said, it had a lot to do with being awake at 4 a.m, playing really bad role playing games with people who are not very cooperative. Oh.
Second question. It was hard to ignore this. Second question is really interesting how, on the one hand, all these things are very, very positive, right? Sort of wanting to be at home, et cetera. But then, you know, when the fleet comes, the aliens will be fucked. So if this is, in a way, sort of a religion, in a way, to me it sounds like there's sort of religious overtones to it. It's interesting how you had both of those things at one at the same time. Feeling of being at home, being comfortable again, and then on the other hand, oh, you're going to be fucked. No. Yeah. I don't know if there's a question there, but...
Oh, okay, well, let's see if I can respond to that. As far as the religious overtones, and was that deliberate, of course, yeah, I mean, there's the humans now have one symbol to unite them, now that the humans are the galaxy's boat people, essentially, and they have the fleet, this legend. I'm sure there are some humans somewhere who still celebrate Christmas as well as best they can, and still have more traditional forms of all the major religions, at least, not a few of the minor ones as well, I'm sure, but certainly the fleet has come to represent a highly mythic, if not quite religious, experience for the humans. Now, is it overtly supposed to represent the second coming of Christ or the apocalypse? No. I mean, this story is very much post-apocalyptic. You can't get much more post-apocalyptic than the Earth is destroyed. I don't think I was trying to go into any sort of abstruse theology, as far as that is. The aliens will be fucked. That's an old joke. It's sort of the way I had envisioned it was a military joke, from the last remnants of human military. When the fleet comes, the aliens will be fucked. And a threat at first, and now just sort of a tired hope. I mean, very few people very few people really believe the fleet is coming to lead the humans to a new human homeworld. The best thing I can of the few who do, I think the best thing I could compare it to would be in our own history would probably be Black Elk and what were the shirts called that were supposed to...
Ghost
shirts, thank you. You know, anybody who really believed in that would probably be behaving on about the same level as that sort of thing. But they're very much in the minority among the human population as I've envisioned it. Very few people really believe a human fleet is going to return from the stars to set them free. Did that answer anything? You wondered if it was a question. I'm wondering if that was an answer.
I think it's fine.
All right, fair enough. Yes, Jim.
It sounds like you've done a lot of thinking about this world, this universe, the history here. Have you done other stories? Have you thought about doing a novel or something along those lines?
Oh, yeah, I've thought of it. I've written a couple of other stories, and I have a couple of more sort of floating in the works in my head. And not sure how to pull it all together into a novel. I'm a little worried because, well, one of the lines of thought and one of the characters I've thought out actually does have a fleet returning, and I'm afraid that's just going to make the whole thing awful too much of a happy ending, rah, rah, humans will always triumph. And that's not really what I was trying to do in the first place, although I like those kinds of stories in their way. I think the best one I've ever seen would have to be Alan Dean Foster's With Friends Like These, if you want a good, the humans come back and kick butt. It's very funny. Any other questions? No other questions whatsoever. Okay, well, yes, Karsten.
Have you ever managed to sell a story to Australia, of all places?
The World Wide Web is a wonderful thing. And the Australians have just about as demented a sense of humor as I do, apparently.
Yeah, they've
gone. That's the best I can do with that. I mean, heck, they produced Mad Max. They've got to have some great ideas down there, so. Yes?
This isn't a question, but I really admire how the first story was just so funny and the second story just so riveting.
No.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Throw praise, throw money. Either is appreciated. Yes, sir.
Is there anything special you do when you're writing to get in the mood or any special time of day or anything?
If I ever wrote when I was only in the mood, neither of these stories would have been written. Sometimes it's, here's the whole thing about artists and inspiration. When you're inspired, and I've got to admit, most of When the Fleet Comes really did flow very naturally, and I don't know what to call that other than a gift from God. I love it when that happens. But I can't figure out why. And if you ever do find a formula, please do let me know, and everyone else too. Bovine Intervention, while funny, it was a lot harder to write. I didn't really think it was as funny as my audience seems to, which I'm grateful. It would be much worse if it were the other way around. And there's a lot of just, sort of putting the figurative gun to your head and saying, you will sit your butt down at this chair and you will not stop your butt sitting down at this chair until you have gotten to the end at the bottom of the page, or for longer stories, until you have gotten at least 5 pages written today. No. there's not really a special formula. Yes?
If a lot of the time this is a gun to the head process, why do you do it?
Why do I do it? There are days I ask myself. Because, boy, every answer I'm thinking of just sounds so, like such a cliche at this point. Nothing good ever comes without hard work. It's because the finished product is worth looking down the barrel of the gun. Or at least, I really hope it is. And when I sell a story, then I feel like it really was, because now other people we'll see the finished product, and I'm grateful for the gun.
Is it a handgun or a shotgun?
That depends on how bad I don't want to write that day. Some days it takes, I think, an entire tank. Are you threatening me back there, the water gun?
Just a water gun.
That's the clarion method. Okay. Any other questions?
What's the third stack of paper?
The third stack of paper is the story I was going to read if we'd had time, but we don't. So, sorry. But in case there's anybody who's an editor out there, it's called Rappaccini's Granddaughter, and it's based loosely off the Hawthorne short story called Rappaccini's Daughter. And I think it's a lot of fun. Hope someday a lot of other people will too. Yes, sir?
What about the cat maintenance and maybe the introduction?
What about the...
Do cats ever give you story ideas? Or what's your connection with them?
Well, my connection with them is in the shape of a small female long hair that runs my life. And she is more often a distraction than help as far as... because playing with a cat is a lot more fun than writing some days. You know, I don't think I've ever felt the temptation to write a cat story. Just nothing's ever come to me. Because cats are so ubiquitous in fantasy and science fiction. There's a whole genre of, romance, bad cat fantasy stories. And cats in science fiction, I mean, for heaven's sakes, there's Larry Niven's Xinti, there's Alan Dean Foster's Tran, they show up in Star Trek every once in a blue moon. And I can't think, I've yet, what?
Spock.
Spock? Spot.
Right, it is cat.
Yeah, see, there you go. I've yet to come up with an idea for using a feline race or a feline that doesn't send me going, that doesn't send my mental editor going, oh, not again. When I figure that out, I'll use one.
Can we get an ocelot?
Ocelot of work, but I'll see what I can do. Thank you for that opportunity.